Hello, cyclocross and mountain bike friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 78 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we have Matthew DeLarme. Matt's a photographer for mountain bikes and cows, but mostly mountain bikes. At least that's where you'll know him. His work is featured on Pink Bike. He's also a staff photographer for the Trek Factory Racing cross country and enduro and sometimes downhill teams, and I'm sure you've seen his work out there. Matt is also was also my roommate for the past week in Lenzahaida for the World Cup, and we sat down one night and talked about many things, about cameras and photography and how he got into the business of taking photos. But then we also just took a deep dive into first enduro and the EWS series, which was really informative for me, and I think you guys are going to get a lot out of that as well. Then we talk cross country and finished it up talking about some of the other projects that Matt is involved with. So go to M DeLarme Photo on Instagram, MDELORMEPHOTO, and follow Matt. And also follow Trek Factory Racing XC and Trek Factory Racing Enduro. And get all those photos that he takes there as well. And Pink Bike. This episode, as always, brought to you by Health IQ. Go to healthiq.com/CXHairs and see if you qualify for better rates on life insurance. And it's not hard to do that because I know you all are out there being active, riding your bikes. You have low resting heart rates. You have good diets. All of these things that go into riding your bikes and having a healthy lifestyle are going to help you get lower rates at Health IQ. They are a life insurance agency that really believes that when you look at somebody's lifestyle and how they live their life, it's a better business decision to invest in you. So they're going to go out and get you better rates for life insurance. All you got to do is go to healthiq.com/CXHairs, fill out a survey, they'll give you a call, and then you will be on your way to getting lower rates on life insurance. All right. This episode also brought to you by the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network, which Crosshairs Radio is a part of, and now that I'm a part of. Pretty excited to be joining Spencer on the management team of the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network. And we got a lot of great things planned going forward, and we've already done a lot of great things that we want you to be a part of. Starting with all of the shows that we have available, including the Slow Ride Podcast, We Got to Hang Out, the new Bike Shop CX show, The Consummate Athlete, been having some great guests on there lately. Check out that show. The Honest Bicycle Program, they are doing awesome work as well. Check out their latest program. And Kids Don't Follow, it's a music show. The Meyerson Line, supposedly there are going to be new episodes. We're going to hold Adam's feet to the fire on that one and make sure that he gets new stuff done. But check out everything at the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network and make sure that you become a member. That's how we are able to continue to bring you all of that content, because you guys support it with your membership. It's only at the very lowest $5 a month, and you can go up from there. We'd love to get you involved and get you a recurring donation from you. Go to wideanglepodium.com, become a part of awesome. All right, let's go back a couple days to a late night in a hotel room in Switzerland and talk to Matt DeLarme.
All right, I'm ready to start. Matt DeLarme, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. We are, 10:18. We're in, I learned this today. Normally, I was saying Lenzerheide, but the guy that was doing the announcing for the downhill was more like Lenzerheide.
Yeah, Lenzerheide. Well, up here in the Swiss Alps, it's very nice, yeah.
So more, I gotta work on my sing set. No errs. There are no errs.
No errs.
Yeah.
No. Maybe we like the errs.
Over and where we're from, but
no, over here, so like the Lenzerheider.
Get closer, don't get all leany back.
Oh,
there.
Sorry.
Not record, and then I'm gonna overpower it, and it's gonna be horrible to.
All right, gotcha. Sorry, I won't be comfortable then.
In the bathrobe and fuzzy slippers.
Oh, yeah, where's my robe?
And there's the unnamed voice in the background as well. So, yeah, we're here for this World Cup race, double weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Our studio is our very nice apartment we got here for the week,
mm-hmm.
which is filled with all of our crap.
Yeah, there's shit everywhere.
The explosion of media. For people who don't know, Matt DeLarm, who are you? What do you do? Well, I'll tell you a little bit. You're a professional photographer.
Yes.
Predominantly mountain bike and cows.
Mountain bikes and cows. And the occasional trout.
And the occasional trout. That's right. Yeah. So fishing, ranches, and bikes.
Yeah.
Those are your specialties.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna get the boring stuff out here first.
Okay.
It shouldn't be boring. How'd you get into cameras, Matt?
You really want that story?
The condensed version.
It was a weird concocted byway to get out of school, basically. I didn't want to do extra school to become a marine biologist, so I thought underwater photography would be fun. And then I kind of took a detour from there. That's the short version.
Yeah. But you actually, didn't you go to like art school for a little bit and then?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Try to figure. You learned everything you knew you needed to know and then you left?
No, I just didn't like being psychoanalyzed through my artwork.
How did you get into the world of bike racing?
Bike racing. My older brother got me into it, I think, when I was about 14 or 15 years old. I was in Vancouver, Washington for the summer visiting my family, and my brother decided one lovely 98 degree day that we would ride our bikes from Vancouver, Washington to Mount Hood government camp. And I would ride my stepfather's 38-pound extra large Winnebago styled Peugeot hybrid, one of the first hybrids of the time. It was a giant steel piece of shit. Well, he had a nice Bridgestone Mile 112. Anyway, I passed out from heat exhaustion at like 3 miles to go, just crashed on the side of the road. And then promptly went out and bought my first like road race bike after that.
So that experience of the 98 degree weather and then passing out was like, this is what I need to do.
Yeah, I liked it better than team sports for some reason.
So did you start racing bikes?
I did. I went back to Maine and raced road with our local bike shop team. And it's just a little.
So it started on the road.
I started on the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that transfer over to the dirt?
I went away from bikes for a little while, you know, college, music scenes, stuff like that, life, before I came back to it. And by then I went out on the road a few times and it was just scary, and I was like, cars, whatnot, getting run over, people throwing like soda cans at you or whatever, and it's like, I'll just go in the woods. Seems more peaceful.
You mentioned, you know, college and music. I want to detour for a second because you that part of your life, which I'm very envious of, was like Pacific Northwest in the 90s. Yeah.
I was pretty much a PDX punker. Hung out in clubs since I was like 18 till whenever. Yeah,
but I mean, some of the, just from stories you've told me, some of the people you're hanging out with, Elliot Smith,
Yeah, some, yeah. I mean, others like my, that. my best friends were, to me, rock stars at the time.
Yeah.
So it kind of, yeah, kind of rock star lifestyle for a while there.
During that, any cameras involved during that time, or was it just like immersed in the scene?
I was just immersed in the scene. I mean, we all played guitars and had, you know, played in basements and made lots of noise and just stayed up all night every night or whatever and hung out in clubs. And there was a long phase with Polaroid Land cameras, actually. Mm. Those were really fun. I still have a few of those from those days.
But I'd say, I mean, some of that, now I'm going to psychoanalyze you. It's going to be like being back in school.
Yeah, I'm going to have another drink.
No, I was just
last week when we're home.
Only to say that I think a lot of your style and sort of how you approach photography, similar to that music scene, is very, very DIY. Just from sort of teaching yourself, and then just I think your style and how you look at, especially, you know, I know you from mountain biking, just how you approach shooting a race or looking for places that may not necessarily be what everyone else is looking at.
Yeah, definitely. I could see that. Yeah. I'm not fond of rules. I'm not fond of the status quo, and I definitely like to go off and do my own thing. And if I sometimes fall flat on my face doing it, I do that. But it's not for not trying. It's just that I don't like the cookie cutter mold thing.
So how did you get to, when did you get serious about photography, and how did that translate into actually making it a career?
I got really serious about it. It was probably about when it really took hold as an idea and a concept, probably about 10, 12 years ago, where I started actually doing research and reading books and figuring out who I respected as a photographer and buying gear and trying to figure out, okay, if I buy this gear, then I can buy this underwater housing, because I really did want to be an underwater photographer.
Mm-hmm. To the point that, like, weren't you, like, training swimming-wise to do that?
Yeah, that seemed like a logical thing to me, and I was like, well, I need to be somewhat decent at swimming, and I went from being a really shitty dog paddler to swimming, like, 3 miles a day in the space of, like, a month and a half, and then I jacked up my shoulders, and it's time to find a different plan, because I didn't do any strength training around it. I just decided I was going to swim.
Basically, literally dove into the deep end.
Yeah, pretty much. That's how I do things.
So once the dream of underwater photography went away, what was the next step after that?
It was just like being outside and using my camera and going and getting up. Like back then, I mean, I lived in Maine at the time, and I was always, every free chance I had, at like up in the White Mountains or like Baxter State Park, you know, climbing Mount Washington, getting up at like 2 a.m. to go try to summit in hurricane force winds and hopefully get a cool sunrise or something, or some alpenglow. And, you know, you had a 50-50 chance there, and then you'd pull your camera out and it would be like a freaking brick of ice. And you're shooting slide film too, so that's even more fun. You know, you're like, please don't break. It's negative 30 degrees, negative 70 degree wind chill. Yeah. So that's sort of how it started. And then, you know, I was riding mountain bikes again. And I started, you know, going out and shooting with some friends from my local bike shop.
So doing stuff like that, where it's minus 70 degrees wind chill factor, sort of set you up for a life in enduro.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, ultimately, you might as well do, you know, if you start out doing things the hard way, you might as well just roll with it.
So going, this is just cracking me up, because we have these conversations like this, and being all formal about it. You are so uncomfortable in your skin right now.
Yeah. Definitely. I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing.
And the peanut gallery is getting a big kick out of it.
Oh, yeah. He loves watching me squirm.
So let's just sort of jump ahead then. I mean, that's sort of the background to it. And then how did it come that you were able to make your living taking pictures of people racing bikes?
So I basically once I figured out that I really enjoyed having a camera along and having some decent riders to shoot with, and I started going to races. Covering regional races. And a lot of my friends on the East Coast that were kind of industry based, it was just sort of one of those serendipitous things where I was basically introduced to the guys at the Climb magazine when they needed a photographer. And that's really where it started, covering the East Coast for them.
And going from there, I mean, one thing that I think people, not only in photography, but I think in many other businesses, don't really understand that it's part being a good photographer, but it's also the hustle after that to try to mm-hmm. sort of chase work.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you gotta be really proactive about it. You know, and you got to not piss anybody off at the same time, because you can't undercut other guys,
because
mm-hmm. they will stomp you later.
Well, it is. And especially in this, you know, for where we're at now at, you know, on the World Cup circuit, but just mountain biking in general, it's not a large community. And, you know, I'm just starting to learn this now. I mean, second year out here in this group, it's a small community, you know, and it's pretty tight knit.
Yeah. And we're a weird merry band of pirates for sure.
And everybody has their clients, and yeah. That's kind of the crazy thing too. I mean, even though, you know, you work for Trek Factory Racing, you also have to go out there and get other clients on top of that to sort of make it a year-long gig.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, you mountain bike race through the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that ends up being your main focus and your main body of work. And it's really hard to get sort of out of that, you know, spring, summer, fall, that's what you're doing. What do you do in the winter? I mean, that's a short window to, you know, be part-time doing something else.
Yeah.
So you make the most and you cram as much into every freaking day as possible. And that's how you got to do it. You got to hustle a lot of clients and eke every little cent out of it that you can, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the fun stuff.
Sweet.
I want to know. All right. So in the past, you've done downhill, cross country, and also enduro. This yes. year, basically just doing enduro and cross country. Mm-hmm. I want to know, because since I've never been, what a typical, I've just seen your pictures, both behind the scenes and of the races, what it's like. Give me a typical enduro week and sort of the craziness that goes into that.
Well, it basically starts with the recce ultimately, and that's the core group of the media guys familiarizing themselves with all the tracks and how to get around, because with the EWS, locations change pretty much every year, except for maybe two or three.
Yeah,
but there's always new locations and the tracks always change, and you need to figure things out logistically.
Give people a little idea. You're basically going to be enduro ambassador here for my audience about, you know, we've talked about it a little bit, but I think on a different level
on a smaller level than what you're seeing at the top level. So just really quickly explain enduro to people who may not know what the whole event is about.
So enduro racing is where you would have a trail bike, you know, 5 or 6 inches of travel. You can have 29 inch wheels, you can have 27.5 inch wheels, you know, personal preference, company preference, whatever, rider preference. Anywhere from 7 to 9 stages over the course of 1 or 2 days. The stages are timed. It's a typically a downhill run. Yes, there are little, you know, climbs in them, but there's, you know, they're mini downhill tracks, basically. Sometimes they're in bike parks. They're, you know, my favorites are when they're in the Alps, when it's natural terrain, when it's little goat pass, when it's, you know, more consequential riding, when it's, you know, you've got to really focus on the task at hand. You can't go full out. You know, little mistakes can have big consequences in enduros. There's transfers between each stages. Sometimes it's lift access. Sometimes you have to pedal. Sometimes they shuttle you to a halfway point. There's a cutoff time for the transfers, but most of the time the riders, you know, they kind of go together. They shoot the shit, have a good time.
Yeah, because that's not right. Scored, nothing. It's just getting to the next right. Section that is.
Yeah, and that's kind of how enduro started, is the idea that, you know, you're out with your mates, you're having a good time, you're riding your bike, but you're still racing. You know, it had that nice kind of mellow vibe, almost like a, you know, it's an off-road rally.
Mm-hmm. Because it started, I mean, it was motocross that started it, right?
Right,
it was
exactly.
French right. Dudes on
motorbikes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so you liaise up the hill, and then...
And they get to use French words.
Yes. Like, they get. Sacre bleu! It is so steep! It's so technical! Yes. So that's the basic format of it. So, so we, the media, need to figure out, A... where we're going to shoot.
Mm. And when you're doing these recces, and this, as we were talking about before we started recording, was the part where I was like, nah, I don't know if I can do this. You're not walking it.
No, we're all riding bikes.
Yeah.
We're taking shitty chances, egging each other on. Half of us are getting hurt. Last week I put a nice big hole in my hand.
Yeah.
No, we're having a grand old time taking pictures of each other. So our cameras are all on each other. We call ourselves the media squids. Squids because, you know, we don't have the skills necessary to be pro mountain bikers. So therefore, yeah, we just kind of flop about the track. But it's just a full day of hanging out with your best friends, being a jackass on a bike, trying to figure out where the hell you're going to go.
Yeah, but you sort of don't give yourself enough credit. At the same time, you're intuitively doing the work of figuring out what needs to be done when the riders actually start racing.
True, but it's hard to call work some days.
And to play.
So once these... I guess, you know, and I want to talk more about the sport itself, but I just, the coverage part fascinates me. Where are you on the course? How do you know when riders are starting to come down the course? What's the communication there? How do you know when, you know, you have certain riders, you're Trek Factory Racing, you're looking for those riders. How do you know when they're coming? I mean, how does it work, Matt?
There are start lists.
Okay.
We do have start lists, and on EWS's and Get This America, for all you enduro organizations and race organizations, the riders come down in allotted times. They are in order. Not just whenever the fuck they want to go.
What are you trying to say about the U.S. scene?
Just, it needs a little tightening up.
Okay.
Because I did have this past month the pleasure of shooting a couple of US Enduros, and it was very confusing for me. It was very loosely run, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I just was like, where the hell are my mates?
So you have your start list, you have your spots, you're basically set.
Right. You have a basic idea of where you want to go, and sometimes the shit hits the fan and you got to alter that plan. I mean, it happened in MEO. I mean, there were delays. We couldn't get back ahead of the group unless we sacrificed certain spots. We had to go, you know, we're like, oh, we want to shoot midsection on stage 4, but we can't do that anymore because we're not going to get back ahead of the group and make it over to stage 5. So what do? You know?
If I am a guy who wants to, heard about Enduro, I'm like, hey, that looks pretty cool. How do I follow it? What am I? Well, one, where do I go, and what am I looking for while the race happens? Peanut gallery's laughing. The hard questions.
Define that question, because that's really friggin' vague.
Well, I mean, there's no TV. I can't go to like Red Bull TV and watch.
No, you can't go to Red Bull TV. So
I can do that with cross country. Main goal right here in this podcast is to get cyclocross people to watch cross country racing. And I think that is a much easier obstacle for me to overcome.
Okay.
We're going into the advanced class now with trying to get them to follow Enduro.
Gotcha. All right.
Because his constituents want to know about Enduro.
They do.
Right,
they do.
Right, 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 right. Right. So you learn about that from the... Yeah. Okay. So so basically there's a couple like major daily media outlets, one being Vital MTB, and Sven always puts out a really nice slideshow of coverage. And then Dave and I always put out daily pieces on pinkbike.com during the races. So there's always daily photo coverage. And then you have the Enduro World Series themselves, which are always putting out daily recaps, daily videos, interviews with all the various riders, photo stories themselves. And you can find them through Facebook and Instagram. And they do a really good job with that. I mean, it would be impossible to live cover a race like that because they cover so much territory. You'd have to have
you basically would have to have 9 film crews.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You'd have to have for one World Cup downhill film crew for each of the stages every day because you couldn't move that. It would have to be pre-set up.
And we already know to cover one downhill run is already costing you, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000.
Give more money to mountain biking, somebody.
So that being said, we're going to EWS, going to Pink Bike, going to these different Vital MTB. Who are we looking at? Who are our superstars right now? Who are the people that we should be watching in Enduro?
Let's see. This year, definitely Adrian Daly right now. I mean, junior last year, and he's pro this year, and he's won a couple. Jesse Melmed, Rocky Mountain Urge. He was actually sick this last race, and I think he pulled off 6th place or 7th place, something like that. It was really quite amazing. He's a very talented young rider, super nice kid. Marco Osborne, he's just a great rider to watch ride because he's just always on the edge, over the edge. You know, it's just, and he's a good character. He's probably one of my favorites. Richie Rude, the world champ, not having the best year, but when he's on it, it's just the most beautiful, brutal riding you've ever seen. It's just ridiculous. Sam Hill, you know, the downhill world champ of quite a few times, that claimed to hate pedaling and now is actually killing it in enduro.
Do you think that I mean, it sort of answers the question, but do you think that that's a good transition? I mean, look at people who have come from downhill versus cross country. Where are these folks coming from usually?
Downhill, or they have always ridden trail bikes in like steep technical terrain.
Is there a core out there coming from motocross?
No. I mean, because you do need a certain amount of fitness, and it's. In my honest opinion, it's easier to be a downhiller mm-hmm. and build your fitness than to be a cross country rider with minimal descending skills and try to tackle like an enduro world series.
Yeah.
So it's going to be much more difficult.
Yeah. Cause downhill is just, that's just a special breed. I mean, those guys to be able to make those snap decisions coming down. It's interesting seeing it more. I mean, seeing like the track walks and all of this, that, you know, they do their homework. It's not just like letting it go, but still at the end of the day it's just the reflexes and the skills and the ability
to shut their brains off for 2 minutes and 30 seconds or whatever. Absolutely. Consequences be damned. Shut it off and don't touch the brakes as much as possible.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I don't think it was interesting because, and this is not to downplay mountain bike nationals and snowshoe at all, but they snowshoe put up a video of the downhill course for U.S. nationals, and I think before I had the experience of actually seeing these courses in mm-hmm. person, I would have been like, oh yeah, that looks pretty insane. Now I look at it, I'm like, oh, that looks like a cross country course.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, back in the day, I'll go to snowshoe. That was gnarly back in the day. Yeah, yeah, like
again, I'm not poo-pooing the course. I think it's gonna be fun. I'm looking forward to it a lot. Right. But it's a different animal.
Right. No, you've not really experienced gravity riding until you've come on to the French Alps or the Italian Alps or the Swiss Alps. It's steeper, it's looser, it's rockier, it's rootier.
And even so the course that we're at today versus some of the other downhill courses that have already happened, even Fort William, mm-hmm. and then even last week, God, where were we last week?
Andorra.
I think the riders were saying were much more difficult than what they're dealing with today in Lenzerheide, which seems really difficult. Super steep, but I guess it's more of a straight shot.
It's more of a straight shot. And what few features they have to check and control their speed are really loose, and it's really dry. Actually, it was raining on the way home from dinner tonight, so that might help kind of calm it down a bit. But there's a bunch of like, you know, nickel to quarter size little chunks of rock that it's like skating on ball bearings. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going, you know, 40-50k into a corner that's that loose, or down a track that's that loose, your bike is just skating underneath you. You know, you touch your brakes and it doesn't matter with that kind of momentum behind you.
Yeah. One thing that you hear about, at least I hear about it, and the riders talk about on these courses, and I'm sort of jumping around, but it happens a lot with these cross country courses, is that they all really like the natural courses.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I think it's sort of indicative of kind of, there's a mentality right now that there's, you know, I only ride park, bro. Those guys. Yeah. That, you know, I'm going to do park laps, ride sweet jumps, which is fun. don't get me wrong, flow trails, but you know, I feel like the mentality is that a lot of the trails these days that are being made, especially maybe stateside, are like IMBA sanctioned, you know, the flow trails, and they're accessible for everybody, which is great for getting people into the sport. But at the end of the day, when it comes time to give it the berries on, you know, natural trails are where it's at. If you don't know how to ride natural rocks and roots and features, you know, you're used to riding flow trails, and then you're like, oh, I'm going to go on a mountain biking vacation. This place looks great. And you go to like Verbier. Gonna get hurt, probably. It's just, that's just the nature of it.
So that being said, you're a guy who grew up on East Coast and moved to the mountains, sort of spent some time on the West Coast as well. When we talk about nationals for this year at Snowshoe, a place you're familiar with, the criticism that I heard, it was always sort of funny from when we had nationals at Big Bear in Pennsylvania, was that it wasn't real mountain biking because there was too many rocks and roots, and this was coming from the West Coast people.
Yeah, the East Coast West Coast argument. Sand and sandstone versus roots and rocks. Yeah,
that's the one.
Well,
give me the virtues of each.
There's two ways to look at it. Look at Aaron Glenn. He's doing just fine with sand and sandstone and Fontana and what he's got. You know, Aaron's just in a league of his own. But I started mountain biking on the East Coast. I love roots. And I feel like if you can't ride roots, you're going to suffer. And outside of Gwyn, I hate to say it, but I do see East Coasters being the more rounded bike handlers, for sure. That's my tactful way of putting that.
With that in mind, all right, I'm gonna put you on the spot here. For think of your Americans right now, in different disciplines. Downhill, you already talked about it for the men. Mm. I mean, Gwyn again for nationals.
Yeah, I mean that's just a given. Lucas Shaw in a close second.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely, especially because that's Lucas. You never know. I mean, if Aaron makes a mistake, that's Lucas' race, because that's his stomping grounds. Back in, you know,
I'm gonna move to this one because we see a lot more of these riders. You know, just sort of how things go. But the women U.S. riders are more of a fixture in the World Cup scene. So we see more of them.
We see more. Yeah, definitely more women than. Indeed.
Yeah. I mean, Howard Gross is over here now, but that's the first time he's been here.
Right.
You know, current U.S. national champion. But I don't know. I'm more interested. I think it's going to be a more interesting battle.
Aaron Huck. Women's
side. Aaron Huck's going to defend her title.
I think so.
Yeah. Even come. Well, she said, I talked to her today, and she likes the roots. She likes the gnarly stuff. So I think that's.
Take that back. Sorry, Aaron.
I also talked to Leah today, who, you know, from Vermont, grew up racing.
Yeah, but if Kate Courtney shows
there you go. That's a good call. Even though she's racing U23 for the World Cups, she's going to be racing elite for the national championship.
No, she's not. No.
She is.
Is she?
Well, that's what I heard today.
Okay.
So I guess we'll see.
Or compelling.
Our peanut gallery is raised eyebrows. I don't know what that means.
she feels she has a better chance and there's a bigger value to her.
Yeah.
And seeing how her early season
domination
against
more
seasoned senior riders.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that's a bad pick.
I think, yeah. And she's proven herself on international tracks several times.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Nova Mesto. I mean, it's just a giant root bed.
Right.
She did fine.
Yeah. Certainly did. Won the race. All right. Can we even talk about enduro for the U.S. national champions? Do you even know who would be a favorite? Can you name the national champion now in men or women?
No.
Peanut gallery?
This would sound horrible. Let me
go to the research library.
This
off,
might.
Guys are off mic, off camera.
This might sound horrible, but I don't think it matters if Marco Osborne doesn't show up.
So what is it? I mean, you're somebody who's immersed in this enduro world, yet in the U.S., you basically, to quote you, it's a clusterfuck. So
there's a disconnect.
Yeah,
yeah, what's for that? Sure. I just don't think America's figured out what enduro is yet.
Yeah. I mean, is it because there's too many series? There's not a unified circuit out there? Is it because there are different, you know, it's not governed by USA Cycling necessarily, so everybody has their own rules? I mean, what needs to happen to make,
I think it's a combination of all those factors for sure. I think there's too many cooks in the kitchen. Absolutely. I think maybe they should all go and see like an actual full on enduro like EWS or, you know, even like a super enduro or a French enduro cup type thing, you know, and see how those are run. And see what kind of tracks they use.
Because do they have to be 2 days, or can you do it in a day?
No, what's you ideal? Do it. I mean, you know, EWS. Let's see, Rotorua was a day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Tasmania was a day. Ireland's 1 day. I mean, it is possible to get through 8 or 9 stages in a day, depending on, you know, it depends on what you have for terrain. It's just. At first, when enduro started out, everybody was like, oh, it's the downhiller's graveyard. And then it became apparent that there were all these guys that actually had come up just riding trail bikes on gnarly friggin' terrain. And that it wasn't really, there were enduro specialists, you know, before enduro became sort of a buzzword.
That's the thing.
EWS really took hold and, you know, enduro was already happening.
Yeah. I think enduro is one of those things where it's a really interesting place in that very few people go out and buy downhill bikes and then go to parks. I mean, there is a community that does that. People buy cross-country bikes and will go out and a lot of times race cross-country. For the trail bikes and the enduro bikes, lots and lots and lots of people are buying those bikes, yet they're not necessarily racing enduro.
Well, okay, so there's kind of two factors to that, I think. A is if you buy a downhill bike, you know, to buy a decent one, you're spending at least $5,000. Then you need pads, all the gear that goes with it. Then you're gonna break shit on it every weekend.
And you need lift tickets.
Then you need lift tickets. Then you need gas
in Kansas.
Yeah. You need gas to get wherever the hell you're going to ride your bike, unless you have shuttleable trails. And then you need somebody to drive shuttle, blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, for one style of riding, that's a hefty chunk of change. And I think bike technology and suspension development has come along so far that your average, five inch, six inch, you know, travel bike is so capable these days that a lot of people can have one bike and go ride really full on gnarly terrain. Yeah, there's some stuff you won't be able to tackle, but you can tackle pretty much a fair amount of gnarly stuff and get away with having one bike and go out with your friends and pedal up the hill and go to, you know, and that's kind of the it's kind of the vibe of enduro, it's riding trails, it's racing trails, and experiencing just riding your bike.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm getting at is it doesn't seem like that community possibly in the U.S. is as interested in actually racing. I mean, they want to go and do that with their friends and go and like ride trails and but that may be where the disconnect is, where if somebody has a cross country bike and they at some point they're like, hey, right, I may want to go out and do an event.
Right, because you're looking at your heart rate and your cadence, right, and your diet and your, yeah, if you have a cross country bike, you're training. Top and level enduro racers train. They train hard. And that's where the format of enduro sort of is kind of like there's two different factors. There are camps. So you've got your EWS series, which is the top, it's the pinnacle of racing enduro. It's become super serious. The vibe is a little less laid back than it was when it started. A lot less, really. I mean, people are serious. They're chasing points. They're, no more backpacks. They're stuffing a tube in bibs that have pockets in the backs, and sewed onto the backs now, and just a CO2 and
talk a multitude about that of levers. Just for a second, because I think that's one of the fascinating parts about enduro is the rules about you're doing all your own maintenance. You're basically riding the same bike,
right?
And you can't. I think the most fascinating part is you can't throw anything away. Oh, we're getting. Oh, is that it, Mitch? Mm. Mitch Rapalato.
Mitch, rope-a-dope.
Is that your national champion for your men? And then Kelly Emmett is your national champion for women. Okay.
All right.
We answered that question.
Yep.
All right. Talk to me about those kind of enduro specific rules, just with, no mechanical support, no getting rid of any equipment and all of that kind of fun stuff, and how it plays into the series.
At the end of the day, that's the thing, isn't it? It's balancing that point between the absolute limit, because if you're riding at the absolute limit, something's going to break. If you break a wheel or need to replace a wheel or a rear triangle, or you destroy your fork, then that's a 5-minute penalty. If your race is gone.
5-minute penalty to do what?
To replace a wheel.
To replace a wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might as well just pack it in. Your race is over.
And for that reason, bike-wise, I mean, what are people, technology-wise, has it sort of plateaued at us? Is anybody running DI2 out there?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
They are. There's minor issues with it here and there, depending on the weather. Mm-hmm. And this year there's been a lot of weather. So yeah, sometimes people get stuck in a gear or whatever. And it's not the most friendly system to maybe for a racer to actually, if they have a problem out in the field, if they can't get back to like a tech zone to have something reset real quick or whatever.
So if you're going to a tech zone, do you have a mechanic there, or are you doing it?
There's usually, if you don't come back, you usually always have to throughout the race, come back and check in,
mm-hmm,
in a main tech zone.
I'm showing my ignorance of the top level enduro right now.
So you can, and you should have, unless you're a privateer, you would have a mechanic and a support crew and the pit stuff, and they can take care of the little things, but by and large you're on your own. So you have to take care of your bike. And I think the best example of that was actually Richie Rude when he first started transitioning from downhill to enduro. Once he figured out that he couldn't do every run like a single downhill run because he would blow up wheels or whatever, and that he actually had to dial it back 5-10%, that's when he became unstoppable.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so he had to basically go all out just to save the equipment to make sure he can finish.
Because it's the bigger picture. You have to take care of your equipment.
So the other interesting part of that, and we've seen, I guess it happened this year already, is getting rid of equipment.
Yeah.
The controversy surrounding
stashing
that.
Stashing equipment. Yeah.
So what's the story behind those rules?
Oh man, I'm going to get in trouble. You know, either some riders are really ignorant of the rules and don't read the rule book very well, or they're really smart and trying to get around them.
But it's basically I guess we saw it with a camelback, and if then you don't want it, you have to sort of keep it the whole time regardless.
Yeah.
Just as a example.
It's certainly a no litter rule.
Okay. Basically what it is you can't.
Ultimately, yeah, it's a no litter rule. I mean, don't leave your shit out there. I mean, come on, you're over the span, you know. If everybody just, you know, I blew a tube and I don't want to carry it because that's weight, then look how much crap we're leaving out. And
human survival.
Right. We
food and water.
Right. We race in some pretty pristine places.
That's the amazing part of it, and I think that is the selling point when people are seeing the covers, is that the places that you know, you've gotten to go and cover, and that's crazy. I mean, like Tasmania looked just insane.
It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. And the trails were fantastic. The people were super friendly.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know what hit their little town of like 400 people, but whatever. Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, don't leave stuff out there. And yes, there have been problems with that, and they haven't always been handled, depending on whoever is running the race, quite properly. Some riders have gotten away with things that other riders have gotten some pretty steep penalties for sure. You know, that's also kind of on the other side of it. That's, you know, it's a fairly young format. It's in a young series. You know, it's growing pains.
Yeah. Back to cross country and what we're going to see on Sunday. And this is, as I said before, sort of my mission statement with these shows that aren't about cyclocross. What is it that gets you excited about those races, and how has the sport evolved for you to make it, you know, more compelling or spectator friendly, or just more of a can't miss event?
It's the idea that those guys are, and women are out there for an hour and 20 minutes red line shelling each other, because that fucking hurts.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it in Andorra, you know. I know you were there, but it was,
I heard Vanderpool went and took the whole shot again. And then
Like he was, you know,
he wanted to make people hurt again
in Belgium still at,
you know, and then altitude caught up with him and smacked him down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that was one of the highlights of the season was Albstadt, was watching him come off the line and just give Nino a run for his money.
Yeah.
Just like, I'm pretty sure all those guys were just basically like, what fuck is going on?
Yeah, and you were actually the first one, I think, to make the comment when the race was over, as opposed to other times that Nino wins, lifts the bike over his head, and then just sort of rolls off where he waited around the finish line.
Right.
You know,
there's only, there's usually only one dude that, that Nino will wait for, and that's and that's Julian. So for him to, you know, he had Vanderpool had Nino's respect.
It's definitely respect there early on. So this this Sunday should be
he gave him a run for his money. And he knew it. Yeah.
And then on the women's side, I think that, you know, on the men's side, and, you know, I've talked about it before, but it's just that it's nice to see somebody give Nino a run for his money. You know, it gets a little, any sport's going to get a little boring if you have somebody just out there dominating especially with Absalon going down, Quahavi, obviously not where he was before. It's, we need something there to sort of shake things up.
But it was nice to see, like, Maxime Marot last year.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, always in his way. Working his way into that, you know, top grade. It changed. You know, you knew Nino was probably going to win majority of the times, but it, but it was nice seeing that top 3 to 5 structure change.
You know,
for sure.
Last week accepted, and I think that he will put it on his own shoulders as tactical error. It's also awesome. You know, we're biased, but seeing Anton Cooper up there, mixing it up with those guys at the front end.
It's you know, maybe a little biased there, but it's good to see the Coop freaking plow through there.
The more interesting, I think, field is the women. I mean, Yana's been awesome the last two races, but you really don't know what the hell's going to happen in that field.
No.
And that's kind of awesome. I mean, know, and we see it, we're sort of like freaking, you know, whack-a-mole sort of popping our heads up every lap and going, oh, look who's winning now, you know, and then go down and run to the next section.
Like, you don't even know what lap it is. You don't know where you are. You're like, who's where, what? Did anybody see the freaking lead moto? What lap number did he have? Like, is it 4 to go, 3 to go? Where's... Yeah.
That was Matt's sort of newbie tip for me last year when I was like, how many laps are left? And he was like, dude, look at the moto. It has a freaking lap counter on the front of it. I'm like, oh.
I just used that thing to check focus on. I'm not paying attention to that shit. I got more important things to do. Just tell me.
But and even this weekend, Lenza Haida. I like the changes. I think this is going to be a fun race. I think the course, I like the course better than it was last year.
I like this course a lot. We just
got out. And now that I know that I can get in that, you know, back entrance, it's a lot easier to cover.
Yeah, that's definitely true. We'll see how that happens on race day.
Yeah,
Swiss Army doesn't shut us down. You must not go there. You must go through the gates with everybody else. This is not the rules.
Yeah, it's about 10,000 people trying to walk through 6 feet. All right, we're going to finish up here. If somebody is out there and not necessarily just wanting, maybe wanting to get into race photography, but even just, you know, the question you hear all the time, I want to go to the race, I want to take pictures of my girlfriend, boyfriend, child, parent, what camera should I get, Matt DeLarme? That's affordable. This is like the hardest question of the day. Yeah, it's not your phone.
You know, for starting off, probably right now it's I do a Sony A6500 with the Power Zoom 18-105 lens. Kind of does
that. That's Sony. We both have it.
Right. That would do pretty much most of what you need to do with one lens and one body.
Yeah.
So you could buy other lenses for it, and, you know, as your budget allows.
So mirrorless camera, super fast. It's the type of camera that, you know, for Matt and I, we both have them, and then we both have much more expensive cameras as well. But that one always gets, you know, 50% of the use during the day.
Yeah. And it's definitely the camera of choice when you're out riding your bike.
Yeah. And it's small.
To carry along. Yes. Yeah, that's the thing. It's compact.
Yeah. That's really I would add to that, if you want to go really small, you know, you're going to lose a little bit of functionality and speed, but still an awesome camera would be the RX 100.
Yeah, definitely. And
those you can just like stick in a jersey pocket.
Right. Just don't get it too sweaty. Don't put it in your back of your bibs.
I've already ruined two of them.
they're not butt crack sweat sealed.
And on that note, I think that's where we should end.
Sorry,
up.
Bill.
Tuning in.
Don't pause it. Hey, just. To end things up and just actually talk about some of your other stuff, I love everything that you post and what you're doing with your Ranchlands project and also starting this book. If you can just sort of give people a really sort of a bird's eye view of what that's all about and what, you know, and the book coming out and what you're trying to achieve there.
So the book is coming out in December, and it really started off as an idea of basically my wife telling me when we moved to Colorado that I needed to find something to occupy my time during the off season. So I'm not a bored pain in the ass.
You don't sit still well. As we're witnessing right now, making you sit in a chair for almost an hour.
I'm trying to put my really sweet hotel slippers on under the table. Where's my robe? So we had moved to a new state, and I knew it was probably in my best interest because I'm terrible at being bored. And I started thinking like, okay, so what can I do in the winter that's different that would kind of give me a fresh perspective and maybe help when I come back to shooting bikes and whatnot. And kind of was like something that puts me, you know, in touch with the culture of the place that I live. And there were kind of like, the two things that like really came to mind were ranching and mining. And I didn't really want to spend my time in a hole in the ground in the dark all the time, because that's not something to really write a full book about or photograph a full book for. So,
and too much like enduro on some days.
Well, you know, the ranch has become that way. I chose ranching, and after doing much research, I found a really, really superb group of people. The most forward-thinking ranchers I've ever met. They do things in a really traditional way. And they're the only ranching group. There's like five generations in now. They're the only ones that in America right now that are partnered with the Nature Conservancy. And they use ranching as a means of conservation, and they teach that for other ranchers coming up that are taking over, because they realize that with food demands and stuff that things can't be done, you know, the same way. There's got to be that level of conservation. So they basically use ranching as a way of, in using the herds as a way to mimic like a natural like elk herd or bison herd migrations, to actually till up the land, not keep the animals on a pasture for too long, keeps the plants healthy, because it's just kind of like a minor pruning, not overgrazing. You know, seeds get redistributed, new grasses grow, places for small animals to take shelter, food for hawks and whatever and whatnot. So they do a really great thing, and I you know, kind of brushed them with the idea, and they we're like, yeah, come on down. And so for the last year and a half, I've been in my free time down there. And usually because I'm pretty shit at riding horses, I ride out on my bike. While they're on horse, I'm on my mountain bike. And I've gotten to the point where I, you know, you watch long enough and you can figure it out, and they all laugh when cows break away and I sprint after them on my bike and bring them back. It's kind of funny. Yeah, and I can, you know, throw calves now and all that sort of fun stuff. So I've kind of been like well initiated in, but that's part of, you know, being good at covering, you know, a subject, is to understand it and to really like kind of watch and pay attention and maybe even take part.
Yeah. So where can people go to see that work and then also to contribute to the cause and possibly even buy a book now before they come out?
So campaign, there's a link to it in my Instagram, MDelorme photo, and MDelorme.com. I have a big gallery of images right now.
They're just spectacular. Yeah. So you all should definitely go check those out. So MDelorme photo on Instagram. That's probably the best place to follow along with all of your, shenanigans.
Definitely shenanigans.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for talking, Matt.
Thanks, Bill.
I'll turn the mics off now. We just can. Oh my God, we already finished it.
I'm gonna. I can squirm less now.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.